This was a wonderful book. I was a little afraid, as especially about two-thirds of the way in, I was going to see a bloodbath at the end. Mm. I won't give away the ending, of course, when I do the report, but you let me down easily. I'm sure that if Michael Cimino had the screenplay for Indian Country, there would be a bloodbath at the end.
Or Brian De Palma.
That's right. But, of course, you did have plenty of violence in it and sex and all the good elements that a novel is supposed to have. Tell me a little bit about how this novel came about. One of the interesting things is its location, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. You know, not too many books are set there. So
no,
just give me an idea about how all this came about.
Well, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is a region that I'm familiar with and have been since boyhood. And when this novel was germinating, I know that I had gotten the idea of setting it up there because I knew the character was going to be one of these people one of these veterans who'd rejected life in ordinary mainstream civilization for the bush. And this happened to be a bush that I was particularly familiar with, as I've just said. And but also because it's what passes for a wilderness in contemporary America, it gave it more of a resonance to the title of the book and the theme of the book, which was Indian Country.
You are from Chicago.
Yes, originally.
But you must have vacationed during your boyhood up there, is that correct?
Yeah. Vacation would be putting on the dog a bit. Actually, is that my father was literally a journeyman machinist for the Continental Can Corporation, and during the summer months when all of the canning was taking place in northern Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota, he had to go up there to troubleshoot the machinery that was used in the canning factories, and he would be gone for 5 months of the year, and for three of those months, the family would be with him. And that's how I got to know that area.
You also apparently got to know some Indians, is that true?
Not really. I'd met a couple. The one I got to know most intimately is when I really got serious about this book, and I wanted to know much more, not only about Indian lore and mythology, but the way that American Indians, or specifically this tribe of American Indians, the Ojibways, look at reality, which is rather different than the way we do. And I dedicated the book to this fellow. His name is Bill Hawk. And he was a rather unusual Indian in that he lived out in the woods during the summers, but he had a doctorate in anthropology and was, in fact, a college professor in American Indian Studies at the University of Wisconsin.
You served in the Vietnam War. You were a Marine. You became a captain?
Marine captain? First lieutenant.
Your experience in the war, how did that parallel the experience of your hero in Indian Country?
Not at all. There was absolutely no parallel. This character was woven, so to speak, from the whole cloth. There's nothing autobiographical in this character in the slightest way. Obviously my perceptions and understanding of the kinds of emotions that a man undergoes in combat allowed me to understand somebody like him better than I would have had I not been there.
Now, in Indian Country, Chris goes through treatment at a VA facility. Mm. Where there are a number of veterans, much like himself. You must have done some research along these lines, is that correct?
Yeah, what happened was that the idea of this novel was first sparked by an assignment I did back in 1980 for Playboy magazine about the phenomenon of emotionally maimed or troubled Vietnam veterans. And I traveled all over the country interviewing them, and went to some of these centers where these kind of group therapy sessions were being held for these men, and that was my research. I didn't know it at the time. It was only after I'd gone through this and actually had written the article that the idea of the book started to come about. So I'd already done the research without knowing what I was researching at the time.
Well, war is a shattering experience for anybody involved in it, but do you believe that this particular war, the Vietnam War, had greater emotional repercussions on the participants?
Well, yes, it did. However, I would be the last to overemphasize that. There was a tremendous emotional impact that the two world wars, Korea, Japan, on men who fought them, and even the Civil War. I had looked into that. Now, of course, the Civil War was pre-Freudian era, and there wasn't a lot of psychobabble going on back in those days. But there were certainly, when you look into the aftermath of the Civil War, you can see a lot of men who fought in that were exhibiting what a psychiatrist today would call symptoms of a kind of battle fatigue. However, now that said, is that I think in two aspects that the emotional impact of the Vietnam War was exceptional, and for, as I said, for two reasons. One was is that the veterans, upon returning home, were met with not merely an indifference, as was experienced by Korean War veterans, but an outright hostility, or at least a perceived hostility on the part of the public who had not been there. And the other reason was that the atmosphere of Vietnam itself, even the physical landscape, was extraordinarily alien to the average American soldier. And the nature of the war, it was a civil war, it was a revolutionary war, it was a guerrilla war, all fought in these dripping jungles, caused a lot of these men to see things and to do things that they had not imagined before they'd gone to the war. They probably, most of them couldn't have imagined themselves doing some of the things they did. And I think that this affected them a great deal.
Of course, Starkman in the book has an overwhelming sense of guilt because he inadvertently brings down the friendly fire, and which results in the death of perhaps his best friend. So he comes back to the United States shattered with guilt for this act, but not necessarily guilt for the war itself.
No. I was rather conscious of that because, you see, what I wanted to do in this novel, and I've tried to do in almost everything I've written, is to take the phenomenon of Vietnam and that era of the 60s and try, as much as I can, to universalize it. Not to have it tied too specifically to Vietnam, so that I really didn't want him feeling a kind of abstract guilt about the war itself. I at least wanted, I knew that in creating this character, I was not going to create a kind of guy that people are going to warm up to begin with. And I really wanted somebody that, a character that readers, let's say a veteran of World War II, could at least identify with. It would make some sense to him. And so for that reason, he feels this guilt, not so much about the nature of the war as he does about this inadvertent killing of his friend. And I also use that to illustrate a particular idea that I've got, is that these guilts and these traumas that a lot of men came back with were in some ways, in an odd way, self-imposed. They, feeling themselves cut off from American society, both while they were there and then when they came back, they removed themselves still farther by, in an odd subconscious process of conceiving of things they'd done there as in a way of being worse than they really were. In other words, that they damned themselves with what they regarded as an unredeemable guilt, a guilt that could not be absolved.
Isn't it interesting that so many books are now being written about that war? It took a while, but books written by yourself and others are shedding more light on the way we thought and the way we perceived that war. Because at the time, I think there seemed to be almost a universal feeling. Well, maybe that's an exaggeration, but a tremendous feeling that we were evil, that we were wrong in that war. I'm not certain that feeling has evaporated, but at least more is being said, and it's showing our fighting men in a different light. For example, Chris and his fellow soldiers. You don't go into detail, too much detail about what they actually do over there, but none of them is pictured as rotten or barbaric in the way that many of the soldiers have been pictured. Is this accurate?
Oh, I think it is. I think that the the perception that I came away with from there was that, you see, under conditions and circumstances such as those that existed in Vietnam, and that men who are fundamentally ordinary can be driven to do some extraordinary things. And I pointed this out very, very clearly in the first book, A Rumor of War. Acts that can be of extraordinary heroism, but also acts of extraordinary savagery. But it doesn't mean that they themselves were savage. I was trying to show that there is a, if to go back to the old radio days about the shadow, you remember him, and who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men, that there is this darkness in all of us that can be made manifest under certain circumstances. Now, I think what made Vietnam an unusual experience, not merely as a war, but as an historical event for Americans, was that for the first time we were forced to confront the fact that we are not necessarily any better than any other nation or culture in the world. We, too, are capable of being very nasty. This is not to say that we hadn't been before. Some of the tales of what went on in the Indian Wars are literally chilling, hair-curling. But back in those days, before there was electronic media, newspapers, there were newspapers, but nowhere near the number or the extent of the coverage that's given now. Those sorts of things were swept under the rug, or the horrors of, I'll tell you one war that was full of gruesome incidents was the Philippine insurrection, in which American soldiers fought in, after the Spanish-American War, and we were putting down the Moro guerrillas in the Philippines. There are accounts of some pretty barbaric acts that were committed back then, but of course they weren't reported, or when the men came back with them, coming back into a basically Victorian culture and morality, I mean, nobody was going to listen to this sort of thing, or if they were going to listen to it, it was justified by some kind of God-given right that we, you know, these people that we had killed were just savages, and so you can do anything you want to a savage.
Well, I remember reading a book by Ira Wolfert called An American Guerrilla in the Philippines many years ago. At a time when the Second World War had ended. And I was shocked by the brutality of the Americans. And I remember there was one scene in which a young Filipino who had been suspected of aiding the Japanese was tied to a tree and beaten and mutilated by American soldiers, and his sister forced to drink his blood. And I was shocked. I was horrified as I read that, because my perception was in the 1940s that Americans didn't do that. But at the same time, the news media that we had didn't report things like that either. And we know about what happened to poor Gary Hart.
Yes.
when these things happened with John Kennedy and the others, they just weren't reported 20 years ago. It just didn't happen. We are more blunt today, I think. Our language is more blunt.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's probably a good argument that you can be made for either side, you know, nothing happened in Vietnam that hasn't happened before. It's just that I think we know about it, and we know about it more clearly than we did in the past. Now, whether or not we ought to know it, I don't know. Sometimes.
I don't think we can avoid it. We are more candid with each other. Mm-hmm. A moment ago I mentioned the language, everyday language, even that which is heard on the radio, is something that would not have been heard, I don't know, back in the 50s when I was a teenager. We didn't talk like that.
No.
But I have an 18-year-old kid who does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's go back a little bit and talk about you and how it all began. In Chicago?
Yeah, that's where I was born, in 41.
Your father was a machinist. You told me that. Did you have a bookish growing up?
No, I didn't. I had a very unbookish upbringing. I don't know how I ended up doing this. But there wasn't any kind of a sort of literary childhood.
What was it like?
It was, I think, a quite commonplace blue-collar background. I would say that we're here in New York, that if you go out to Queens or certain sections of the Upper Bronx or Yonkers and all that, it was that sort of an upbringing.
So you never pictured yourself as a writer?
Well, I had pictured myself as early as my early teens, or at least mid-teens, 15, 16, somewhere around there, as a newspaper man. I had gotten very interested in journalism. Picturing myself as a novelist that early, no. I hadn't.
Where did you go to school?
Well, I went to school at Fenwick High School in Oak Park, Illinois, which was a western suburb of Chicago. And then...
Oak Park, isn't that where
Hemingway's
from?
Yes, yes.
Sure, something in common there.
Yeah.
Literary background.
And then I'd gone to college at Purdue University and at Loyola University of Chicago.
What did you study there?
Well, at Purdue, I studied aeronautical engineering for almost 2 years, at which I proved to be an utter dismal failure, and transferred to Loyola as nothing. I had no major because I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I took some tests, and the tests showed that I ought to be an English major, and I said, well, since I need a major to graduate, then I'll pick English. So that's how that came about, and I got a BA in English in 64.
Then what happened?
And then I went into the Marine Corps.
How long did you serve?
3 years.
And
most 3 years, 3 months to be exact. The 3 months in
most of
in
that
OCS.
Time. Most of the time in Vietnam.
About half the time. I was in Vietnam 16 months, and then I was in training obviously for a total of 9 or 10 months. Then I went over to Okinawa and places like that for a couple of months, and I was in Vietnam for 16. Came back, finished out my last year in the Marine Corps in North Carolina.
What happened after you got out?
Well, by that time, I had already gotten an idea that I wanted to write a book about what I had experienced and seen. And I had called it back then, this is 1967, A Rumor of War. And it started off as an autobiographical novel. I, in fact, began writing it while I was still in the Marine Corps and stationed at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. And after I got out of the service, I had about 100 pages of this novel written. They weren't very good. In fact, they were dismal. And I came back and went off to Europe for 6 months, 6-7 months, thinking that Europe was a nice, inexpensive place to live and I could finish this great American war novel there. But Europe proved to be much more expensive than I thought. My talents were not very well developed at that point. The book wasn't turning out right. And so... and then I ran, most importantly, out of money, and returned to the States. Did some advertising work for a while, and then started off as a cub reporter for the Chicago Tribune in '68.
I understand you were an investigative reporter at one point with the Tribune. Mm-hmm. It resulted in a Pulitzer Prize. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I was part of an investigative team. We did 6 or 7 major stories. Well, one of them was the definitive story, at least at the time, of the way the Daley Democratic machine, Mayor Daley type, and of Cook County used to rig elections and commit vote fraud in a very widespread and flagrant manner. And the team had won the Pulitzer Prize for that. I shared in the winning of it.
Well, you must have had time to go back to your autobiographical novel at some point.
Well, I didn't. As I said, I dropped doing it in 68 or something like that. Somewhere along about 1970, I picked it up again. I'd had it aside for 2 years and still couldn't make it work. And then I was transferred by the Chicago Tribune overseas as a foreign correspondent in 72. And I then began trying to write the novel more seriously. I mean, you as a journalist, I think I probably would appreciate that it can be a very demanding profession, and especially if you're a foreign correspondent. There were many times I would work 10, 12 hours a day, sometimes 7 days a week. So trying to write a book in my spare time was a difficult thing. But somewhere, I think it was after about a year of hacking away at this, it occurred to me that for various reasons I couldn't make this thing work as a novel. It might have been working in journalism then for several years that made me embarrassed to do something imaginative. I don't know. But I said I knew I could do this book much more easily if I did it as nonfiction. I would feel much more comfortable writing it that way. And so sometime in 73, I started writing A Rumor of War in the version that eventually was published in 77. It took me a total of about 3 years to finish the book.
I have this feeling that most newspaper men do want to write fiction. Mm-hmm. Most of them don't, and many of them don't do it successfully, but you did manage to do it because you went ahead, back to fiction at some point. So tell me how you got back in from the nonfiction into the fiction area.
Well, I think once I had gotten that book under my belt, and it was, though it was not an imaginative work, it was a literary effort at any rate. I felt perhaps a bit more confident, especially to even writing in a long form. You know, after writing 600-word dispatches and things like that, the idea of writing 150,000 words is difficult to conceive of itself. And I'd gotten an idea for a novel while I was covering a story, in fact, for the Tribune overseas. And Rumor of War was commercially successful enough, and I got an advance for this novel idea that was sufficient to allow me, say, when I had a wife and two kids, and to say, well, I think the hell with it. I'll just quit and try this. It, as you said, it's almost every newspaper man's dream. You know, I'm going to quit this business and go write a book. And I said, well, you know, I don't want to end up being 50, 55 years old and looking back and saying I wish I'd done that. So I thought I'd take a crack at it.
And you succeeded.
And pulled it off.
Was it hard?
Yeah. Yeah, very. In fact, as it gets harder, it doesn't get easier.
You no longer work for the Tribune.
No. I haven't since September 77.
So you're
10 years.
Nearly. Now you're writing fiction full-time.
Mm-hmm.
You still based in Chicago?
No. I live in Florida in Key West.
Smart?
Yeah. No. Chicago is, everybody knows what that's like in the winter.
Are there distractions in Key West at all that would make it hard to be a writer there? I know so many people go down there, but I just wonder, it seems like such a playland that...
Well, a lot of people say that, but in fact, it can really be kind of dull, actually. There's not much else to do down there except drink and fish. And if I love to fish... But it's not a bad place to work because, in fact, there's more distractions in a city like New York or a Chicago or a Los Angeles than there is in a place like that.
Or sirens, at least.
Yeah.
Key West is quite a literary colony, doesn't it?
Well, it's become one now. It didn't used to be, but it is now.
Tom McWane had a house down there.
Yeah. Oh, well, there's now something like 50... 50 writers and or editors or whatnot that at least live down there part-time. But, yeah, Tom McGuane used to live down there. James Merrill still lives down there.
Is there a writer's bar?
No.
You guys hang out?
No, there really isn't. There isn't an aversion of Elaine's or Harry's American Bar in Paris down there.
Well, Philip Caputo, this An Indian Country is a wonderful novel. It's a novel, in fact, difficult put down, and I certainly am going to be in a position to recommend it to my listeners, and I appreciate very much the fact that you took the time out to come in and talk to me about it.
Well, I appreciate your feeling the way you do about the book.
Thank you.